Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Here we are. This is The Interpreter Show. Martin Tanner in studio today with Bruce Webster and Dan Peterson, and by phone, Mike Parker. Gentlemen, welcome to The Interpreter Show.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Martin.
Wonderful. You're welcome, Mike. This is a new program here on KTalk Media. It's the opportunity for you who are listening to talk about religion, related topics, whether they're LDS or not. We would enjoy having you call. We hope to present you with scholarly information, new religious updates about things that happen, things that are of interest for Latter-day Saints and other Christians, Jews, and whoever else likes religious topics of all sorts. So with that little background, I also wanted to tell people, since this is a fairly new show, a little bit about the Interpreter Foundation itself, which is the sponsor and impetus behind this program. Dan, you started the Interpreter Foundation, so talk to us for just a minute. Tell our listeners what the Interpreter Foundation is, what its mission is, and what you're accomplishing.
Well, the Interpreter Foundation was begun really the last week of July of 2012, and by the first week of August, so about 9.5 days later, we launched our journal, and we've published at least one new article, every Friday ever since August, whatever it was, of 2012. So we're nearing 300 weeks, consecutive weeks, sometimes more than one article. And that journal, Interpreter, a Journal of Mormon Scripture, is available online for free at no cost. And then it can be received as print on demand through Amazon at cost. So we've put out hundreds and hundreds of articles, and the basic goal of Interpreter is to pursue research into the scriptures and the beliefs of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from a faithful perspective. We make no secret of the fact that we're committed Latter-day Saints. We believe this stuff. But on the other hand, we're also trying to keep pretty high scholarly standards, but make it accessible to a broad audience. And the great thing about having an online journal is that it's accessible to people in Perth, Western Australia, or to Gambia, or Central Asia, wherever, at no extra cost. If they can get access to a computer, they can get to our journal. And then we're doing other things besides the journal, books, the occasional conferences, this radio program. We've dipped our toe into filmmaking. We're doing a lot of interesting things.
Movies.
Yeah.
Which is pretty remarkable for such a young organization. Bruce, what are some of the things that you've enjoyed about Interpreter?
Well, I am a long, long time Back to the Foundation fan of the original Farms. You know, collected the various Farms publications, had them online, you know, had them... I still have copies of most of the farm publications, both the journals, the books, everything else. Unhappy when Farms sort of lost or changed its direction at BYU. I'll avoid all the discussions there. So I was actually quite thrilled. I mean, I've known of Dan's work for many, many years and was quite thrilled when he started Interpreter Foundation. Immediately looked for ways that I could participate and help out there. And as you know, all three of us have been doing have worked on the gospel doctrine video roundtables. And I look forward to the email every Friday telling me about the new articles in the Interpreter Foundation, and I always find them interesting. Even when I don't agree with them, I find them interesting.
Mike, how about you?
Oh, my background is very similar to Bruce. I think I discovered Farms in the late 1980s or so, back when they were doing mostly, if I recall correctly, photocopies of old articles that were out of print and so forth. and really followed Dan's work and others published through Farms up through the 90s, and really had a great opportunity to come to be associated with Interpreter. Haven't done a lot of writing for them so much, but I have done some of the podcast, the video podcasts that about gospel doctrine lessons and so forth. I'm really excited right now. Some of the stuff that's coming out from Jeff Bradshaw, who is publishing these no-whys on the Old Testament, very similar to what Book of Mormon Central has been doing on the Book of Mormon, their no-why section. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about some of those tonight.
So let's definitely do that. For our listeners who may not know the background of apologetics, and I'll do this in a nutshell in, you know, 1 minute or less here. 40 years ago, other than Hugh Nibley, who was this big defender of the faith, you had very little going on, but you had a lot of activity from some critics of the church. As I like to label them, my thankfully distant relatives, Gerald and Sandra Tanner, which I actually said to them over the air. And I get along great with Sandra, and Gerald's passed away. But there are other critics of the church who would just come after the church, and people would wonder, where can I go to get responses? Is there a response to this? What is going on? Have I been sold a bill of goods? And to fill that void, you know, along on his white horse came Jack Welch and FARMS, which is the acronym for the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, and it started to publish at a small snowball. You know, kind of looked like the prophecy of Daniel. You know, it just rolled and got bigger and filled the whole earth. There's this avalanche of great research and information that bolstered people's faith. And I remember one of the early FARMS banquets, then elder, now president, Eyring, made comments along the lines of, and this is, of course, just a paraphrase, but the gist of it was, this is really great. This gives people a climate in which they can feel confident in their faith, or words to that effect. And it was just such a great comment. And I've always felt that way. The more I delve into some specific issue, if you really, really dig into it, after a while you can be confident that it will really come out in favor of the church and in favor of Joseph Smith or whoever the critics are taking pot shots at, because I'm convinced this is absolutely all real. So that's the short little apologetics background. And the void has now been filled, and the banner has been carried on by Interpreter Foundation and Book of Mormon Central and Fair Mormon and a bunch of other places that people can go to find good, valuable information to defend positions of critics. So that now if you look, instead of wondering what's going on, you can kind of roll your eyes and go, well, that was answered 37 years ago in this article. So it's great. It's great. A number of different topics were thrown around by us as to things that we might want to talk about today. Maybe we could start off briefly, Mike, with one that you tossed out. Latter-day Saints are studying the Old Testament in gospel doctrine this year, and a lot of people will open up their King James Bible and they think they know what they're reading, and maybe sometimes they do, but this is 400-year-old English, and it's nice to sometimes supplement the information that's in there. And you know, Mike, you came up with some of your favorite new modern English translations of the Bible, and I have some that I particularly like as well. Why don't you talk for a minute, Mike, about the translations that you find particularly of interest?
Thanks, Martin. Let me follow up on what you just said a moment ago about the King James. I'd start off by saying that the King James is, of course, the official Bible of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. That's been declared by the First Presidency. It's in the church handbooks that is the Bible that we prefer. largely because it has the same wording style and so forth with the Book of Mormon and other modern scripture. And so it's much easier for Latter-day Saint readers to see the connections that would be easily missed in a modern translation of the Bible. However, that doesn't mean that modern translations are bad or not helpful. In fact, there are many passages in the King James, as you just mentioned, Martin, that are either difficult to understand, sometimes not correctly translated, or are based on manuscripts that the King James translators had that were not very good manuscripts. So there's a real challenge for the modern English reader with the King James Bible. If you know your Shakespeare and you go to Shakespeare plays quite a bit, you'll probably do okay with your King James. But for the rest of us, it's a little bit tricky. So what I've recommended to Latter-day Saints in classes that I've taught is to get a good, reliable, modern English Bible that you can read not as a replacement, but side by side with your King James. And it helps to clear up some of these difficult passages. Probably the one that is most widely accepted in the scholarly world is the New Revised Standard Version, or NRSV, New Revised Standard Version, which showed up in 1989. It's actually a descendant of the King James through a number of revisions that were released over a period of decades. The New Revised Standard Version is the most recent incarnation of that. What's nice about the New Revised Standard Version is that it doesn't go out on a limb with going in weird directions with things. It stays pretty close to the King James cadence and style. It's very easy to read alongside your King James. I have several others, but just one that I'll mention, and maybe I'll throw it back to you, Martin, because you said you had some you wanted to share. Another one that I really like is the NET Bible, or New English Translation. Now, this is a brand new translation, came out in 2005 from a team at the Dallas Theological Seminary. The translation itself is very good. It's a little bit looser than the King James or the New Revised Standard Version is, so it doesn't read quite as well side by side with the King James. However, what's really nice about the NET Bible is that it's got these amazing footnotes. It's about 60,000 or so detailed footnotes that explain possibilities on cultural issues that are going on, or if there's a word where the translators weren't certain if they should go with this translation or that one, they chose one for the translation, and then they have an extensive footnote talking about, you could go two or three different ways with this. So it's very upfront about why are we choosing this word versus other words. It's a very good Bible. I enjoy it. So that one's actually available for free online, by the way. You can get that at netbible.org, netbible.org.
And it is a great translation. If you actually bought it in print, it weighs about 30 pounds. I don't know if it's quite that much, but with all the footnotes, you get the first the first verse of Genesis, and there are three or four pages of footnotes and commentary. Mike's right. It's incredible as a resource. Let's take a call. Caller, you're on the air with the Interpreter Show. Question or comment?
Yes. Martin?
Yes. Your first name, please, and your question or comment.
Oh, this is Thomas Rogers in Bountiful.
Tom, thanks for joining
us. First of all, I want to encourage you to get up tighter on your mic.
Will do.
You sound like you're kind of in a barrel sometimes.
Well, the room does resemble that a little bit. We'll try to get closer to the mic. Thank you.
But also, I contributed with Nibley. I mean, contributed material for Nibley while he was writing One Eternal Round. What's the status on that book? I haven't seen it out in the public. Of course, I'm visually impaired, so I couldn't see if it was out there, but what's the status on it?
Hold that thought. Commercials wait for no one, because that's how we pay for this show. Stay tuned. We'll be right back, caller. This is the Interpreter Show on KTalk Media. We'll be right back. And And we are back. This is the Interpreter Show. In studio with me, Dan Peterson, Bruce Webster. With us by phone, Mike Parker. I'm Martin Tanner. Back to our caller. While we were taking our break, I took a look, found that One Eternal Round was published in 2010. It's available. You can find it on Amazon. Maxwell probably still has it. So it's out there, caller. It's out there.
Oh, okay. I hadn't been aware of that. I'd been busy doing other things. But I was really honored to help Nibley with some of my Hebrew background. I was able to bring him data when he was able to validate it in the Evangelii Deduce, or the Gospel of the Twelve. It really excited him. So he had to go back and rewrite a chapter. But I didn't know if it had been out there. I hadn't had an opportunity to follow through on it.
That's a great contribution, caller. That's fabulous.
Anyway, all right, so it is published. It was published. It's available then.
Yes, it is out. It is out.
Oh, I'll have to see.
Martin?
Now you referred to Jack Welch, or is it John Welch? I was thinking it was his name John or Jack?
Well, Jack's his nickname. It's John Welch.
Oh, okay. When you say Jack, I say, wait a minute.
Sorry.
I sat on the stand a couple of times with Nibley and with John. And
same guy.
I didn't know if I was up there with the wrong person.
Oh, same guy. Just sorry. He has a nickname. Yeah. And Mike, you were going to comment.
Oh, I just wanted to comment for the reader that it is available in Kindle on Amazon.com, and I believe that Kindle will read the book to you. You said that you were visually impaired. So you might want to double check on that, or have someone double check on it.
Oh, have an audio then.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Hugh was desperate to get that work done. Of course, he did contact me for the issues with his health, but then same time it's kind of, serendipity that with my Hebrew background, I asked him if he was aware of a couple of things that might be contributory to the writing, and he was really excited. So I'm hoping to read that and see if my material made it there.
Sounds like a great contribution. Yeah,
Nibley was a great friend.
He was a fascinating man. Someday I'll get brave enough to tell my little Nibley story where I asked him about Adam Gott, but not tonight.
Yeah, in fact, I connected Hugh Nibley with Wayne May, and Wayne May brought out one of the artifacts that had been discovered there and the findings there in Illinois and Indiana. And when Wayne May brought this artifact that indicated that Christ was here, it was like Nibley was like a kid in the candy store. He was so happy to have this artifact in his own hands that validated the fact that the people in America knew of Christ.
He would have enjoyed that. Thank you. Great call. Let's take another call. Hi, caller. You're on the air. Your name and your question or comment.
Yes, my name is Frank, and I would like to know, I understand Lilith was supposed to be Adam's first wife. Where do Mormons stand on Lilith?
Anybody want to tackle that?
I don't know if there's an official stance. I can't remember any statement from the church or any church leader about Lilith.
There's no scriptural reference to Lilith. It basically derives from Jewish legends and elaborations on Genesis. But
wouldn't that be... wouldn't that be true for almost everything in the Bible? Just, Jewish legends passed on?
Well, no, I'm talking about there's no scriptural indication of it. There's that which is actually contained in the Torah, and there's other elaborations which were often informative or at least interesting, but there's certainly no indication on a scriptural basis that there was a Lilith or that Adam had a wife before Eve.
So no versions of the Bible have Lilith in it?
No.
Correct. None. No. Zero, none.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know, because I looked it up and it said Lilith was Adam's first wife.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, John.
There are people who believe that, but they believe that from sources other than
the scriptures.
Bible.
Yeah.
That's right. Thank you. Great comment.
Thank you.
All right. And, you know, we've had callers without even tossing out our phone number. If you'd like to join us with your question or comment, if you would like to join us, give us a call. 801-254-1640 is the call-in number, 801-254-1640. And you will be on the interpreter show with Mike Parker, who is with us by phone, Bruce Webster in studio, Dan Peterson in studio, and I'm Martin Tanner, rounding out our group. We were talking when we took our break about, or when we started to take our calls, about different translations of the Bible, and we had just talked about the NET version. The New Revised Standard Version is the one that most scholarly institutions will use. So if you were to go to Princeton Theological Seminary, or I picked that one because I love Bruce Metzger and some of the guys there, James Charlesworth. But if you went to almost any of the major theological seminaries, you know, if you talk to Bart Ehrman or somebody who's very famous, they would all use the New Revised Standard Version in the classes that they teach. That's just kind of the staple. It's a fairly literal translation, but it's in modern English. If you want something that's a little simpler English, one of the newer translations that I really enjoy is the Contemporary English Version. It doesn't get everything right, but it's got this fabulous set of footnotes that goes through the Old Testament and the Apocrypha and the New Testament, and it's great, and it's very frank and forthright. You can go down to a lot of footnotes, and it will say in a little politer words than this, but nobody really knows what this means from the ancient Hebrew, and so we're making a really good guess, and other people guess other things, but nobody really knows, and it just is point blank about things like that, and it's fabulous. So I kind of like the Contemporary English Version.
One of the things I like about these one volume modern translations with notes, the annotations, is that, you know, there's the world of biblical commentary is endless. There are vast commentaries. You can drown in it. You can drown in the commentaries on a single biblical book. And for most Latter-day Saints, most gospel doctrine teachers and students and so on, they just don't have the time for that. But quite often these notes in these one volume editions are very judiciously chosen. They're just about the right amount, often with line drawn maps and so on, that really you're getting the best of the commentaries. So the Reader's Digest version, if that reference makes any sense to anybody anymore, but it's you're getting enough but not too much. So I think it really makes a difference. You know, the first 5% of the information is the information that's going to make the biggest difference for you. After that, you can get lost in the weeds, but they're usually pretty good on that.
That's a great observation. That's a wonderful observation.
One translation I really like, Robert Alter, a Hebrew scholar, has done his own translations with commentary. And he's published these as separate books, so you have a big, thick one, the books of Moses, which are the first five books with his commentaries. And usually, like some of the ones you guys are describing, you have about a third to a fourth of the page of the text is the scripture, and then the rest of the page is commentary. And he strikes a nice balance. He believes more in some of the essential unity of the books, of the composition of, say, the books of Moses and so on, than other scholars. But he's also very frank and forthright about the context and derivations. I learned a tremendous amount about Jewish practices, particularly he actually makes, you know, the book of Numbers and Deuteronomy and so on interesting, because he's talking about here's a background, here's what they're doing, this is why this happens this way, this is what this does. So that was actually, I think, 8 years ago when we were going through the Old Testament. I was reading to my wife out of that, and I would read a few verses, and then I'd pick some of the commentary to read to her as well. Another good one is the Jewish Study Bible.
Yes.
Which is a great, that's sort of one of my references. If I'm really wondering about a particular verse in the Old Testament,
I'll go to there, and they have, again, they have the commentary built right into the, alongside the text, parallel to it, and so those are both things.
The only problem with the Jewish Study Bible, it's a little weak on the New Testament. That's a joke.
A little weak, yeah. One of the neat things about many of these modern translations is you let scholars do all the heavy lifting for you, and so you can look at these early verses of the Bible, and by early I'm talking about some of the oldest and most ancient and most difficult to really comprehend, and they put it in modern, simple English, so you can kind of get it. And when that happens, Numbers becomes understandable. You read through Isaiah and you go, oh, this is what it was all about. And these concepts are made much simpler to understand.
Sometimes one of the things that helps simply is the layout of the text on the page. Sometimes if it's poetry, it puts it in poetic form. Or if it's a dialogue, it represents it in dialogue form. And you don't realize how hard the King James sometimes makes it with its simple, layout as verse after verse after verse. That's useful in some ways. But in terms of understanding the structure of a text, or they'll have section subheadings and so on, so that you know, oh, now we're talking about a different subject. This is an oracle against Assyria. The previous one was against Babylon. Something like that. This will, it really helps you to get a sense of the lay of the land.
Let's take another call. Hi, caller. You're on the air. Your name and your question or comment.
Well, sorry to be a double-decker here, but you just mentioned James Charlesworth.
Yes, James H. Charlesworth, Princeton.
Yeah. Let's see, his work was the Pseudepigrapha, isn't that correct?
He did, yes, a commentary on the Old Testament Pseudepigrapha. He also did a fabulous book called Jesus Within Judaism. It was a wonderful book.
Yeah. In fact, if my memory is correct, he actually came out to BYU and sat with Hugh Nibley and me and a few other scholars, but I Hugh actually was working more from the H.R. Charles pseudepigrapha. That's an earlier version.
Yeah.
But I, I just wanted to see if that was the right James Charlesworth.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
He did. Okay, that was my only query. I'm just trying to fill in blanks.
That's the guy. Fair.
Because I'm
enough.
Blank.
Thank you. Thanks for the call, Tom. And the clarification, Tom. Bye-bye. Okay. That frees up a line. Give us a call, 801-254-1640, 801-254-1640. Let's talk about something else. Let's shift gears, unless anybody else has more to say about translations of the Bible that might be helpful. This year, Latter-day Saints and others around the world are studying the Old Testament, and that, for many, seems to be one of the most difficult parts of Scripture to understand. You know, there are people who, when it gets to that year, think, oh, man, should I change faiths for a year so that we can just... I'm kidding, of course. Yeah, I don't really know anybody who does that, but it's a hard rotation. Any thoughts? We've had the thought here about more contemporary versions of the Bible, which is huge, but any other tips, thoughts, issues that you might come up with for Latter-day Saints who are studying to try to really understand events that happened 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago in some cases?
Well, there's some resources out there that, and I know that Mike, I think, wants to talk about some of the no-wise, the Old Testament no-wise that we've been putting up on Interpreter from Jeff Bradshaw, which I think are a tremendous contribution. There's some other things I might just mention in passing. Ben Spackman does something called Benjamin the Scribe, and he offers, it's online material, he offers material on the Old Testament. He's trained in these things at the University of Chicago and at BYU. And BYU Studies, I believe, has been putting out some materials on the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. So there's some good things for Latter-day Saints. And then, of course, we've mentioned these, not only the new translations, but the annotations in them, which can be very, very helpful. For those who haven't tried it, believe me, this will make a huge difference in your ability to understand what the text is about. It really can open up. You'll say, oh, my word, so that's what they were talking about. I never got it.
So that's what this means.
But, Mike, did you have something you wanted to say about the Noahs?
Yeah, Jeff Bradshaw has really got some good stuff out. I believe that these are being hosted on Interpreter's other website. Interpreterfoundation.org. The main website that Martin already mentioned was MormonInterpreter.org. Gosh, why am I blanking right now? Fill me in here, Dan. MormonInterpreter.org.
I can't remember what it is.
It's MormonInterpreter.org. Is the main one. Yes. If you even just Google Mormon Interpreter, it'll show up. So
it'll come up. So yeah, InterpreterFoundation.org is a sister website that has some other content, and all of Jeff Bradshaw's Noahs are over there.
Explain what those are. Give some background for our listeners who really don't know what that is or where the word comes from. Talk about those for a second.
It's spelled, this is a visual pun, it's K-N-O-W-H-Y, Noahs. And Book of Mormon Central for several years now has been issuing these, I believe nearly daily, Noahs on the Book of Mormon, covering all of the research and scholarship that's been done on the Book of Mormon on virtually every verse. We'll talk more about it when we get back.
We will. You're listening to The Interpreter Show on KTalk Media. I'm Martin Tanner with Bruce Webster, Dan Peterson, and Mike Parker. We'll be right back on the other side of this break. Stay tuned. Interpreter Radio. Martin Tanner in studio with Bruce Webster, Dan Peterson, and Mike Parker by phone. Let's go back to the phones and talk with our next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
If you went, well, I called a compliment.
Actually, hold on just a minute.
Okay.
I pushed the wrong button here. There we go. Now your turn. Hello? Maybe not. All right, let's try again. Go ahead. You'll have to talk a little bit louder.
Okay, I said I called to compliment you. I enjoy your show.
Thank you. Okay, perfect.
Okay. Now, this is what I think you do for people who call your show. You enrich their souls.
That's our hope. That's our desire.
Well, I think you do it. You see, contentment comes when you know that the start of something that your soul gives to the heart of other ones. And I think that's what your show does.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
You're welcome. I know I enjoy listening to you, and I like to look up these little cliches for you so that I let you know that I enjoy your show, and I know the listeners do. And you know, if you think about it, there's a lot of lonely people out there when you're on the show that want to pick up the phone and call in.
You know, that is very true, and whenever you have people from one religious denomination, they have all these phrases and concepts that they've gotten used to, and somebody from a different faith may not understand them very well. So it's great for you to point it out, and good for us to try to do our best to make things understandable for everyone.
And that's right. So somebody is waiting for someone like you to brighten their day through a kind deed or two. And that's what you people do when you pick up that phone for somebody tonight.
That's so kind of you. That's kind of
you. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so
yeah.
much.
God bless you.
God bless you.
I enjoy your show.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Sweet lady. Whatever your denomination is, if you are a believer, that's the ultimate goal, isn't it? To have faith in God and to be of service to others if you use Christ as your model or whatever great religious figure. Let's take another call. Caller, you're on the air. Your name and a question or comment.
Is it me?
It is you.
Fantastic. My name's Hugh.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm a little bit curious about the hieroglyphs in the Pearl of Great Price.
Okay.
And just because I've got family members who claim that those couldn't be translated by Joseph Smith, and I'm curious how you...
Wow, I don't know what happened there. Let's give it a shot. Caller, this... The Joseph Smith papyri and the Book of Abraham is one of the areas that I really, really have strong feelings about, because if you go out on the internet or to other areas where you find critics of the church, they'll say something along the lines of, well, we know Joseph Smith was a fraud because the Joseph Smith papyri were found and they were published. And Egyptologists say they don't say, they can read them now, they couldn't in Joseph Smith's time, so nobody could check up on them, but now they can translate them, and they don't say what's in the Book of Abraham, so he was a fraud. Boom.
Right.
Now that's pretty persuasive for somebody who doesn't know the rest of the story, sadly. The rest of the story is that we know from contemporary sources that there were several lengthy, long scrolls of papyrus, and that the ones were found were not the lengthy scrolls from which the Book of Abraham was translated, but the kind of cool, neat parts that were starting to get scuffed that were at the beginning of the papyri and that had the pictures on them. And so they were cut off and put under glass, and those were the parts that were found. And if you assemble all the Joseph Smith papyri that were discovered back in the 60s, you got about 3 feet. Maybe 11 little pieces out of scrolls that were probably upwards of 100 feet in length. And so it's kind of sleight of hand to say that we found the exact stuff that was translated into the Book of Abraham, because, frankly, we have not. And we can even show that from contemporary records. If you want a great book on that subject, there's a brand new one by John Gee, Genuine Mormon LDS Egyptologist. It's called An Introduction to the Book of Abraham. Very inexpensive, fabulous book. It'll answer all these kinds of questions.
Yeah, let me repeat that. It's John Gee, that's G-E-E, An Introduction to the Book of Abraham. And John is a superbly trained Egyptologist. He's a believing Latter-day Saint. He also did graduate studies at UC Berkeley and a PhD in Egyptology at Yale University. And he's an extraordinarily accomplished Egyptologist, and this book is his attempt to answer in very, very accessible language, but with a great deal of authority, to deal with just about every question that keeps coming up about the Book of Abraham.
It's a fabulous book. You should get it. But I did that sort of answer your big basic question that seems to come up over and over again?
Yeah, I think it's a big stumbling block for a lot of people in the church these days, or they use it to be a stumbling block to themselves as an excuse, I guess. But, it's good to have more information so I can possibly have something to discuss intellectually with these people who intellectually want to engage, I guess.
Sure. The short answer is what was found was not the basis for the translation of the Book of Abraham, although some of the facsimiles are in there. And John Gee's book can can be a great resource to show the details and how that can be demonstrated from contemporary records.
Let me add something to that. This is Dan Peterson talking. I wrote a number of years ago an article in the Ensign called News from Antiquity. It's about the Book of Abraham, and it was my attempt to write a consensus statement. I talked to a lot of my friends, including John Gee, who was a friend and former student of mine, and others, and tried to put together an article indicating where the Book of Abraham stood in terms of its relationship to the ancient world. And the thing that strikes me is that people tend to focus on how we got the Book of Abraham, and they often ignore what the contents of the Book of Abraham are. And those contents are remarkable, and in many ways they have clear, very clear parallels to the ancient world in ways that I just find impossible to imagine Joseph Smith coming up with on his own, just out of his imagination. It fits the ancient environment that it claims to come from awfully well. So even leaving aside the question of the relationship of the Book of Abraham to the papyri, just looking at what we have in the English Book of Abraham, it's a stunning little book. It's not very long, but it's densely packed, and there's a lot of it in there where we can point to things in the ancient world that Joseph could not have known, but that we now know about the ancient world, about ancient Egypt and elsewhere, where we think, how in the world did he get that right? And that needs to be explained if you just want to write it off as forgery.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Ask your critic, family members or friends, just how would Joseph Smith have come up with the Plain of Olishem?
Yeah.
Which was not discovered until well after the time that he passed away, but is now known to be an ancient, authentic site.
Mm. Okay.
That's just one little pick out of many. The way it perceives the cosmos is another great one, and there are a bunch of others.
The whole idea that Abraham was an astronomer, that's not particularly prominent in the Old Testament, but it's very prominent in a lot of non-biblical material about Abraham, very ancient material. Even in the Quran, he's described as being particularly focused on the stars, and that's what you see in facsimile 3, Abraham seated upon the throne of Pharaoh, reasoning upon the principles of astronomy. That's amazing stuff.
How would Joseph Smith get that? He couldn't have. Not from contemporary sources available to him. Just no way. No way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate the info and interesting topic.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. That's fabulous.
You know, hey, Martin?
Yes, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, there's another aspect of this, and initially what I thought the caller was talking about was the facsimiles. There are characters in there that can be translated and that don't line up in many cases. There are some exceptions to that, but don't line up in many cases with the, it's not really how it's listed as a translation in the Book of Abraham. I believe it's referred to it as I don't have the document open, but I can't remember what it called. Anyway.
Explanation.
Explanations. Thank you, Dan. Explanation. An explanation is something different from a translation. It's something that we need to keep in mind is that the facsimiles that we have in the Book of Abraham were originally drawn for use in a specific context, and at some point were repurposed by someone else. Now, who that someone was, we don't know. One particular theory is that it was an early Egyptian Christian around the time of Christ or so, which is when the Book of Abraham papyri date to, that he took these drawings, which originally had to do with Egyptian funeral rites and so forth, and that he said, you know what, this can be used to represent Abraham on the altar. This can be used to represent Abraham meeting Pharaoh and so forth. And so we need to be really careful that we don't throw out the facsimiles and say, well, wait a second, we can translate these characters, we can translate Egyptian, and Joseph Smith got it all wrong. That's really missing the point. The point is that what we have are drawings that have been retasked for a different purpose.
Well, that's a wonderful point. And another point that John Gee has made is that we do have a number of other lion couch scenes that reference Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and prayers, and so on and so forth. And so the whole context that Joseph Smith is describing is authenticated, at least in concept, by other finds from ancient Egyptology.
This is Bruce. Yeah, let me jump in here too. And building upon Mike's point, which is very important, there's an extremely contemporary social media equivalent of it, which are memes, where you take a frame or a set of frames out of a movie or a well-known picture, or on Facebook you see a lot of classical art memes, and then people basically come up with different dialogue for it, or they reinterpret it or reapply it to a completely different situation. We think that's new and trendy, but this has gone on as long as humanity has gone on. That, you know, images, drawings, statues, creations, which are originally intended to represent one person or idea or concept, are repurposed for another. And to think that, you know, if it's an ancient drawing and someone happened to write this around it, therefore this is all this drawing has ever meant or all it was ever used to mean, is far more restrictive than actual human history demonstrates.
Great example, Bruce. Thank you.
It's kind of what Jesus did, was repurpose the Old Testament for his own use.
Yeah.
It's not an image, but he was all the time quoting from the Old Testament and say, well, you've been told this, but here's what I'm telling you to do now.
Or for that matter, Matthew is fond of taking Old Testament prophecies and sayings that really weren't prophesying the things that they were prophesying, but saying, hey, the Old Testament says this. This is what I'm doing. And that was considered appropriate.
Absolutely.
And absolutely meaningful. It wasn't a misinterpretation. It was a repurposing of the language, of the prophecies, and so on.
Yes.
And
very
Paul is even worse at that. If you read Paul's interpretations of Old Testament passages, I mean, a contemporary Jew or even a modern Jew would look at this and go, where is he getting this from? It's just out in left field. But, you know, this became the foundation for Christian doctrine and so forth. He was on to something here by retasking some of these passages in the Old Testament.
Absolutely true. And gentlemen, our hour has flown by. That's it. Join us next week if you're out there in listener land to the Interpreter Show, where we talk about religion and related subjects that deal with the LDS faith and other points of view. I'm Martin Tanner, Bruce Webster, Dan Peterson, and Michael Parker.
Whether it's for weight loss, next week.